Philosophers in
space, 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 space.
Weapon selection is critical. If I see one more idiot attacking a Jedi with a blaster pistol, then I'll kill them myself.
All these questions? Is a little blind faith too much to ask?
If you want a picture of the future, imagine a clown's shoe stamping on a human face forever.
I've never felt like a she or her, so I would prefer they or them.
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. This is episode 134. I'm Thomas. That's Aaron. How you doing?
I'm great, Thomas. I'm jacked into my VR happy place. I am avoiding dealing with ephemerals as much as possible at the moment. It's, you know, I'm excited that you've taken up reading. I really think this is great, and I'm looking forward to getting to do a bunch of covering of some really choice brain candy.
Yeah, no, I like that. In the past, I read nonfiction extensively, and feel like I read quite a lot. But then it's not considered reading until I read a book that you like about some replicants and stuff. Like then exactly. Now I'm a reader. Yeah. But that's okay.
Yeah, now sure. You're a reader. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
I feel like we're covering the Babaverse book 2, For We Are Many is the title of it. I've read all the all 4 books now, and I love them. And we're going to do our best to remember what happened in this particular iteration of the Babaverse. I feel like I would be the Bob that, like, frame-jacked the other way, you know? And then just like, oh, crap. I 200 million years went by. I'd be like, oh.
I just got as far ahead as possible.
I wouldn't have really meant to. I'd just be like, I get bored at some point. I'd be like, I'm just going to frame-jack to, like, I don't know, next week. Just, you know, see what's going on. Oops. 200 million years, and then it would be some Twilight Zone-y thing where it'd be like, you know, just everything would be deserted. I'd be like, oh, why didn't you wake me up? That's what I'd do.
I feel like as you start to spread von Neumann probes out into the universe, the odds of a kind of Twilight Zone-y sequence like that approach 100%, right? Yeah. Like, inevitably, you get a Bob out there on his own in the middle of nowhere going a little weird.
Yeah. Thing is, there's a lot of, like, time in the universe. There's a lot of time for, you know, I don't know. I guess that's part of the
and
science.
Space,
of
you could argue.
Yeah, space is not. I was taking that for a given. That part is fine. But I feel like there's a lot of time in the universe between now and heat death where, like, you could wake up and then there's another species that, and you're like, okay, I'll just go with this. Yeah, that's fine. I'd be like, well, I was with those people back 200 million years. You know what? It's fine. I'll just pretend I'm with you. You folks, whatever biologicals you are.
I feel like I would be the Bob that would try to figure out some way to replicate forgetting things because I feel like I would be, because I don't know. I feel like, you know, partly just because I've become so incredibly forgetful over the pandemic that I just feel I would see the value of forgetting, and I feel like a key part of sanity is forgetting things over time.
You're right on, and that definitely has a big place in book 2. Which we will discuss. With that said, I think we should hop in our VR for the purpose of exposition. Our exposition VR. Let's fire up that scut, everybody. Subspace communication universal transceiver plans that we all sent you. You should have all gotten that by now. And bop it!
Bop it!
You're traveling through another dimension, beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
All of our technology, like in the Babaverse, runs on pop culture references.
Yeah.
That's consistent.
Well, I was going to say, does each listener have, like, their own guppy? Like, the guppy would be Lou, who can bop it or something. You know, like, each of them has, like, the AI that can, like, the bop it AI.
I think it would probably be a poor choice for you to compare our editor to a giant fish person. I feel like that could work out not so well for you, is all I'm saying.
Uncharitable interpretation of what I've done, but sure.
A fairly high level AMI is what you're suggesting.
I was thinking more like, remember in like Halo with the, you know, what's her name? Oh, that Cortana. Yeah, she took off.
Cortana,
She's in everything now. She's in Windows or something, I think.
She's in everything now.
Didn't they go, didn't GLaDOS Windows, still. Yeah, Windows turned into the, turned her into like the Siri. We're just setting off everybody's devices. Let's just keep saying, let's keep naming things like Google, Siri, Cortana. And I bet a bunch of our nerd listeners have it set to computer. Computer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yep. Now that we've set off everybody's devices in the entire vicinity, what if that
was like... It's
impressive
how close we've gotten to the Bobaverse already, given what you just described, you know?
Yeah. Well, not only that, I was just thinking, like, that's our version of a Bobaverse. Like, that's our attack that we can do. That's kind of our, like... You know, computer virus attack is we just say all those names and then it Fs with everybody listening to us.
Yeah, it's like a denial of service kind of attack, I feel like.
Well, now that we've messed around enough and I've probably earned myself some very unflattering editing from our esteemed Guppy, Lou.
Stern emails from our from our listeners.
Let's talk about Bobaverse book two called For We Are Many. This one involves, it has a bit of the vehement arc that we already sort of introduced and argued about last time.
Classic. So classic us.
Introduced for the second time in book two, apparently. And also we get a lot more stuff with the Deltans, which is the species that, is that original Bob, or not original Bob, but like Bob One or whatever who messes with the Deltans? Yeah.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, Bob One becomes obsessed with the Deltans.
Mm-hmm. And is kind of hanging out there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. What do we need to I mean, this I think the major arcs that are interesting is they're trying to track down, you know, Vehement is sort of this terrorist organization that's taking out a lot of their developments. They're still trying to find a way to move the humans off Earth, you know, because Earth is dying as it is in most sci-fi. accurately described in most predicted by nearly all sci-fi, humans have effed Earth, as will happen. And so Vehement is messing with that. They blow up they blow up a donut, one of Homer's donuts.
That's right.
And
some platforms, I think, things on Earth get attacked as well.
And it's interesting because they seem to be so sophisticated that I was wondering if it was going to turn out there was like a Bob that went bad or something. I texted you my prediction. I was like, I feel like
you did.
There's a Bob that went bad somewhere along the line that's going to lead to this Vehement. Turns out, spoilers on this book, of course. Turns out not quite true, but sort of true. Because close. One of the major arcs is that they determined that Homer has been infected by Vehement and essentially was hacked and taken over. And that was an interesting thing to think about. Like if you were one of these Bobs, if you're a von Neumann probe Bob thingy, to be like hacked. And the way they present it, he presents it in the book, is that like Homer is almost a captive in his own body kind of thing, or his own, I guess, mind, where it's like he can see what's happening, but he can't stop it, which is interesting. I think that's a little, what is it, Ghost in the Machine or whatever? Like it's a little bit like Cartesian theater, like the idea that the Homer, like consciousness or sentience would work that way, that you're like a little Homer within a Homer doing, you know, so I don't know. You'll have to tell me how the philosophy holds up there, but you know, whatever, it's a book, so it works out. But that's one of the central parts of this plot, is that they eventually determine that Homer's been hacked and they figure it out. And it's once they get Homer out, essentially, once they sever that connection and like clear his system and all that, he's like severely traumatized by it, because they essentially made him like kill a bunch of people and pull off these terrorist attacks and stuff. And Homer is like deeply affected by it. So the reference you made in the beginning of the show, part of the problem is that he can't forget, like they don't forget anything. And I think that's a really interesting robot thing. Like I think they touch on it. Don't they touch on it a bit in Westworld, where it's like a lot of the trauma the robots have faced in Westworld, like it's always kind of present because of the way their minds work. I wonder how realistic that would be. I mean, obviously it's all speculation, but if you were some sort of, you know, being with perfect memory that just does not degrade, I wonder how that would work. Or would it be that, like, in order to be sentient, in order to qualify as sentient, would you need to have some, like, task focus switching ability to begin with that would kind of take the place, like, would prioritize where your focus is in ways that would make it so, you know, this wouldn't be that big of a factor? What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think it's a really good question. I don't think being able to forget is a necessary condition for sentience. I think you could have a sentient being that doesn't forget anything. I think having the ability to forget is an important evolutionary feature for us, and it may be something that's necessary for all flourishing. I'm not sure one way or another, actually. I do think it is really interesting the way that different sci-fi books deal with this question in terms of what level of control the artificial entities have over their recollection. I'm reading Moon is a Harsh Mistress right now, which has an AI that has some control over its own memory in these kinds of ways. And so, like, the flip side of this would be, in theory, you know, the AI can fully erase its memories in a way that you as a human being might not have that kind of control in the other direction. So I think part of what's really, I think, great about this part with Homer, if I remember correctly, is, you know, he has the option to erase the memories, but he feels guilty doing so. So, like, he's sort of got that kind of survivor guilt that makes him feel like he has to carry that stuff with him. So it's a really impactful part of this book, I think, is just the coping with Homer, and it sticks around through the later books for sure.
Yeah, well, in this book, and sorry, I dipped into the philosophy section a little bit.
No
there.
Problem.
I want to talk more about that, but I suppose for the purposes of exposition, and again, spoiler alert, you should just read these books because they're great. And even if we spoil them for you, still read them because they're great. But what happens is throughout this book, book two, eventually, Homer actually kills himself and erases all his backups because he can't deal with it. And like you say, the guilt part, I'm trying to remember, was it that he felt like he would feel guilty to erase the memory of the things he did? Like, or also was it that, you know, in order to go back to an installation or whatever you call it, an iteration of him, you know, there's a lot of his, like, life that he would have to reset, and he just didn't. It's interesting. It's like he didn't feel that he wanted to do that, but it's almost like, well, if someone could have done it for him, you know, like that would have been okay. But that's a really interesting, like, ethical issue to talk about later, I think.
Yeah, I think it was interesting because there's a whole problem connected to this as well with the emotion dampener. So yeah, we'll put a pin in that, and I'll talk about that some in the Philosophers in Space. But yeah, I think we should also, I guess, introduce more about the others since we only mentioned them.
Oh,
some
sure.
In the first one.
Yeah. So well, I guess we'll finish off the vehement arc, which ends up being like a little bit. You know, this is why we're both having trouble remembering some of the stuff about vehement, because it's kind of. It kind of peters out a little bit, like it's like two villains ago for us, and it wasn't like that. It wasn't as good a villain as we thought, maybe, because they did have the Homer hack, which was really interesting. But once Homer kills himself, the Bobiverse is very affected by it, like deeply affected by it. I'm not gonna lie, I'm a little sad about it too. Definitely. I liked Homer. He's one of my favorite Bobs. It was a cool arc that he had. They are like go on a mission. The Bobs have been, I hope we've described it properly, like Bobs in general as a personality has been, you know, not a pacifist, but not looking to fight, you know, wanting
a fairly introverted nerd would be, I think, the right way to sort of characterize.
Introverted, like programmer nerd, but also like pretty fundamentally decent too, you know, like not, you know, because you could imagine an introverted programmer nerd, or at least the types that, you know, harass us on Twitter. You could imagine a certain hostility there sometimes to that archetype, but not so with Bob. It's like a introverted nerd, but fundamentally, you know, decent, ethical, you know, at least trying to be ethical, you know. I would say
last week's content gave us the perfect description, right? Bob is a liberal. He's an atheist, peaceful technocrat. That is the right.
Yeah. It must have been the, you know, his parent, Bob's parents must have sat him down at a young age and said, we are
atheist technocrats.
And so, this is a bit of a change. Like when Homer kills himself, this is a bit of an abrupt thing for them. Like, they're like, okay, we are hunting down Vehement on a personal level, you know, and they mm-hmm. the Bobiverse at this point, they have Bob Moots, which I like. It's like Ent Moots, you know, in Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. That's where
good
they
use
all,
of the word moot.
Yeah, yeah. They all fire up. Yeah, you know, our podcast could almost be a moot. Maybe that'll be, yeah, mm-hmm. it's a weekly mm-hmm. moot. They all fire up their faster than light communication that they develop, which is, you know, a good technology thingy to throw in your book so that everybody can. I think you need that because all the Bobs, assuming they don't get out to a certain, you know, distance. I like it because what happens is Scut, the faster than light stuff is invented, and then they send out the message of how to install it, and it can only, so that thing, that message can only be light speed because the Bobs that are out scattered about in the universe don't have it yet. So I like the idea that, like, as that radiates outward, it's, you're finding, picking up Bobs. And it takes, like, you know, years to get to those Bobs. But then once they get the message with the instructions for how to set up the communications, then they can instantly communicate back. And I just think that's a cool, like, device. It's kind of fun.
And it's particularly important, I think, for some of the philosophy we're going to talk about today with game theory, because one of the major concerns when you're thinking about intergalactic game theory is communication speed. And so if you take out of the equation the problem of faster than light communication, that sort of radically alters your game theory models, I think, to some extent, much the same way that if you were to manage faster than light travel, that would also sort of radically shift your game theory models. So yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's also, since you mentioned the word moot, I have to just bring this up. It's always been funny to me as a weird kind of irony that moot is both a word for a group meeting in which something is meant to be accomplished and an adjective that describes something as pointless or no longer important.
That's funny.
That always struck me as amusing.
Yeah, right. Is that like the same root or something, or is it like just a
I have no idea. Yeah. I just find it funny.
Yeah.
I'm not one of those entomologists.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Oh. Entomologists. Ent etymologists, come at us. Yeah, I never knew if moot was something. Like, I love Tolkien because a lot of these words, I can't assume that they existed before I read them in Tolkien. I'm not. He invented some words, and I don't know which ones are ones he invented and which ones aren't.
And Ent is amongst the hardest of the languages to learn, let's be honest.
It's
very slow going.
So, So we wanted to tie out the Vehement arc. So, you know, they hunt down Vehement. They're very personally motivated, and they track him down. Now that they aren't going against another Bob, now that they've kind of severed that connection and cut out the hacking that took place, I think it's a lot easier for them to beat Vehement. It was interesting to think. And this is something that I kind of wish for more in these books, which is more super AI game theory. You know, like, there isn't much of that. And it might be that it's just so, it would be so hard to write because it's like, obviously it's like writing, you know, how do you write a chess game between two better than human level players? You know, it's like, you'd have to be amazing at that. But like, so this is not really a criticism of the book. I think it might just be fundamentally very difficult to do. But one thing that I thought maybe we'd get a little peek at in these books is, okay, what's going to happen when you've got super AI, super beings that are going against each other in ways that, like, is going to be hard for a human author to even capture. And, you know, it makes sense that it would be hard for a human author to capture. We get it here and there, but now that that Homer is taken off of their, you know, team, the Vehement team, then I think it's pretty easy for them to track down Vehement. And so it's cleaned up pretty fast. And that's why, you know, we're on several villains down now. So he finds the ultimate bad guy behind Vehement, and we come to find out that his name's Vickers, I guess, and Vickers invented replicant systems.
And that's his motivation, as far as we can tell. It's not a very well tied up story.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, a little bit of a letdown, sort of. And it's just, I guess, because of that. And then Faith stole that technology from Vehement. And I think that, you know, so whatever. I think Vehement wanted to take out the Bobs, you know, like, fundamentally because of that. And they take out the leader. That's the end of Vehement. And so we got a couple other subplots. I mean, there's the others. There's also The Deltons. Do we need to talk about the Deltons in this book much?
I mean, I guess we should. I would like to spend more. I mean, like, not unlike the books themselves, I would like us to spend more time on the stuff in space than the stuff on planets.
Okay.
Because I do think that, you know, I think your explanation for why this is the case, that he always spends a lot of time talking about planet side activity, is accurate, that it's easier to write about less evolved species than more evolved species in a sense.
Yeah.
But I do think it's a shortcoming of the series to some extent. And it's something we'll talk about more next episode when we get into some of the philosophical debates that I think are actually connected to that particular issue. But yeah, I guess we could like briefly mention what's happening with the Deltons over the course of this book and then focus on, you know, setting up the Others' War.
Yeah, so I guess if we could try to tie up the Delton thing. I think fundamentally in book two, the arc, what happens is, and I actually do enjoy it because Bill, Bob one, he's intervening with these Deltons. There's like they discover that like there's another super apex predator on Delta Ridney, whatever the planet is, that, you know, he's been moving these Deltons around and they're becoming more advanced, you know, and he has his favorite, which is Archimedes, and he's trained Archimedes. So he's kind of invested. He's almost a parent to Archimedes. Well, he is kind of like a parent to Archimedes, and it's like a parent who you're rooting for the kid in the sports, you know, competitions. And then you're kind of become like the I don't know what the word for it is, the soccer mom or the hockey dad or the something, where it's like, you're too invested in what's happening and you're trying to, it's a reflection on you kind of thing, which I liked. I thought that was fun. And the problem is that they've made a few mistakes in that they haven't accounted for everything on the planet. You know, Bob and the other AI that he's working with, I think it switches out, like one of them leaves. And so they've moved the Deltons to a new spot. And so it was like using up a lot of political capital to kind of do that. And then it turns out the new spot is also not safe because of these giant birds or something that they didn't account for. And so then they try to move them again. And at this point, the Delton like leadership is getting a little tired of Bob, you know, of Archimedes and Bob. And so he's kind of used up a lot of goodwill. They take out the new, you know, bird predator that they didn't realize. But in the process, because of the sort of the display of how powerful Bob is, the rest of the Deltons become afraid, and they're like, I thought it was a really interesting, cool moment where they decide as a government or whatever, you know, that they're like, we don't want Bob around anymore. We recognize that you could probably just kill us right now for saying that, but we don't really. And I thought it was interesting. I was like, yeah, that seems kind of realistic. You know, I like that. And so the ultimate end of the arc for book two is that Bob eventually utilizes android technology to be able to become a Delton and like blend in with the Deltons.
Yeah. It just gets worse.
Gets worse? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, it gets worse in the sense of I would already argue, as I did in the first session of the first book, that like this is a giant cope strategy for Bob One dealing with like trying to have a humanity as an artificial entity by sort of taking on this parental role. And it gets worse in the sense that when he's kicked out as the sky god Bob, he comes back as a Delton. And as we'll see more in book three, you know, to quote unquote, he goes native in that kind of sense. And I would say is sort of getting pulled further into what I think is more of a problematic spiral rather than dealing with stuff.
I guess. Yeah, I thought it was cool though.
It's bad in terms of. Yeah. It's not my most favorite part of the book. I'm not saying it's bad. I just mean it's evidence of, to me, how all of the Bobs are dealing with their new reality in less than perfect kinds of ways sometimes.
Well, you say new reality at this point, it's like a 200-year-old reality. You know, it's interesting. I guess
right, but when you have an infinite lifespan.
Yeah. Well, sure, but at what point, you know, is your new reality, how many years does that have to be until that's reality and your tiny human life, you know, of 30 years or whatever, however old he was, you know, it's interesting how fundamentally that still determines. I guess because the original programming or the original upload, that's still very fundamentally present all the time, despite how many hundreds of years go by. It's interesting.
Yeah, we'll talk about in book four. I think you start to see the kinds of drift that you have in mind there. It's something like, you know, 200 years out or something. You start to see.
Well, but that's more sort of, that's replicative drift, not necessarily drift within.
I think there's both. I think there's both replicative drift, and I think there's what I will call vampire drift, in that it, to me, perfectly replicates the way that they describe immortal vampires who sort of try to have a life weary of that and, like, go off and do their own thing in weird ways.
Yeah. Well, now that we've tied up the Deltons, we can finally get to your favorite part, which is the others. What did you want to talk about with the others? I mean, we discover a bit more about them. They are the ones, if you remember, who had the, like, ant technology, sort of a tie into Children of Time a little bit. They have like the ant technology that just takes all metal, like everything important to their development from planet systems, and just like kills everything there. And it's a scary species. It's a scary villain. I like it. It's kind of Borg-esque a little bit.
Yeah, we learn a couple interesting things about them. We learn that they're building the Dyson Sphere, so superstructures start to factor into our discussions. For folks who are not familiar, the Dyson Sphere is a sphere built around the sun that alternatively, or both probably, captures maximally as much energy as you can from the sun, while also providing, in theory, a bunch of space for people to live, potentially. So it could be a habitat as well. And then there's also, you know, they interact with them. They finally communicate with them, and they learn that they are some sort of like hive species that is stuck in one system, it seems like, because they don't like to create new colonies, which I think is an important point that'll sort of play an interesting role even after the others are gone. And then I think, yeah, the other important thing is that they're just sort of happy to sort of slowly go around consuming all these resources to build up the Dyson Sphere. And they think that all other species are either food or pests, essentially, right? Yeah. They have a kind of xenophobic chauvinism towards any other species.
Yeah, they are. It's an interesting thought. It's like a super powerful species, but fundamentally they're still like bugs or something. Like they're not. They have no interest in diplomacy or, you know, any other rights of any other beings. They're just like, why is this food talking to us, kind of thing. And yeah, you bring up the thing with it, like, also because of the way their species is, they don't form any other societies and other or you know, like colonies or anything, because then I think it's like any other colony would have like another king or queen or leader or whatever their word for it would be, and then that thing would become like a rival to the one leader that they currently have. And so like they don't do that, and they only strip all the resources and are just building up this superstructure in their home system.
Right, exactly. So they are sort of put forward as there's zero chance that you can sort of reason with them, and they are maximally immoral in the sense that they are happy to take everything they want and like steal, you know, and murder, wipe out entire planets, entire civilizations, including, you know, we come across another species. There's something else to note about this universe. The author of this leans heavily into the idea that the universe is highly populated. We've talked before about like Fermi paradox stuff.
Would you say highly populated? I mean, he's on the high end of the spectrum, I would say. Light years, and there's what, like three?
But almost every system has had some form of life that we've come, it's been above 50%.
Because I thought one of the things they were commenting on is I thought the Bobs were worried about like a lack of sentient life, and then once they figure out what the others are all about, they're like, oh, maybe this is a solution to the Fermi paradox. Like the others are killing everything, so that's why we haven't come across more things. That was my memory of it, but my
sense of it is that they very quickly sort of start to feel like they're finding a lot of habitable planets in Goldilocks zones that have some degree of life on them, and sort of a fair number of them seem to be fairly advanced.
Well, we got to get to the philosophy, so I guess one last thing I wanted to add on the others is they also there's a sense of inevitability. Like, the other side of them not treating the Bobs or anybody as, like, people is that they're also not in a hurry to, like, go get them. So there's mm-hmm. essentially where they're at is, okay, eventually these others are going to try to just take over the entire universe. Like, they have no sense of stopping. They want the resources. So then the Bobs are scrambling to, like, figure out, okay, what's going to be the next system on their path? And it's kind of a calculation as to, like, how many minerals are in this system and is it worth their time kind of thing. So it's sort of this ominous, you know, countdown kind of thing of like, where are they going to strike next? It's not as though the others are specifically looking to try to take out the Bobs, but they also are just going to do, it's like inevitable that they're going to take over everything eventually.
Right. And we do see that start to shift, I think, right at the end of book two, because mm-hmm. we get the battle for the Pavonis system, I think is the right name, right? Because of the Pavs. And in that battle, the Bobs, it's a pretty cool battle. They do a pretty good job with it. And it's sort of, that's where the others decide, oh, y'all are pests and not just food.
Yeah.
So we're going to, like, focus on finishing you off sooner. Well,
they do, yeah,
later.
And they do lose the bat. Like, they blow up, the others blow mm-hmm. up the whole Delta Pavonis system, and the Bobs collect like 20,000. And there's discussion of, like, how do we pick 20,000 of the species to survive? You know, like, this intelligent mm-hmm. species kind of thing. And so they do that and try to preserve, like, this species as best they can and get out of there because the others have are destroying everything, and they kill a number of Bobs in the process.
Yeah. 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 So I think that's great in terms of plot so far. And we can pick up the paths a little bit more in book three, where we can talk more about the different species and the interactions between the Bobs and the ephemerals. So I think let's do a little philosophy, shall we?
Why don't you just tell me the right answer?
Well, that's what's so great about the trolley problem is that there is no right answer.
This is why everyone hates moral philosophy professors.
The one I want to talk about this time is in relation primarily to the others. And it's this sort of continuation of discussions we've been having around game theory and space and first contact. When we talked about Blindside in particular, you know, I talked a good bit about sort of the situation of first contact with something like a Rorschach and how that situation is likely to end up with violence, right? It's a mutually assured kind of destruction. And we talked about why those likely outcomes were. And what I really was shook by as I was reading the Bobaverse series was thinking about how, you know, the problem is already in play before you ever meet the Rorschach. Mm. It's not like once you've met Rorschach, game starts. It's like we're already playing a game against enemies we do not know exist, right? Players that could be out there that we can have yeah. very little information about. And given the amount of time it takes to prepare any sort of countermeasure or anything like that, we are at this sort of fairly extreme disadvantage, it seems like, and in a pretty dark situation. So I'm going to actually, I feel bad about this. This is a little bit of me stealing from Paul to pay Peter or however it goes. but I want to reference something that actually gets sort of well laid out in a book series that we're going to read down the line when I figure out how to better approach it, which is that Three Body Problem book series by Liu Cixin. I'm probably getting that wrong, but it's the second book in the series is called The Dark Forest, and he presents this kind of account of how to understand the universe by comparing it to a dark forest. And when I came across this, it was very much the sort of encapsulation of the concerns that I was having as I was thinking about the others. So I want to read you this passage from that book. And when we get to that book, we'll eventually, you know, find something else to wrap on about this. But here's what he says. The universe is a dark forest, Every civilization is an armed hunter stalking through the trees like a ghost, gently pushing aside branches that block the path and trying to tread without sound. Even breath is done with care. The hunters are to be careful because everywhere in the forest are stealthy hunters like them. If he finds another life, another hunter, angel, or demon, a delicate infant to tottering old man, a fairy or a demigod, there's only one thing he can do: open fire and eliminate them. So the argument sort of goes, there's no good reason to either expose your existence as a species to the general universe or let any other species live that you come across in the general universe. That essentially we're all in a game of, you know, laser tag or something where first one to get shot loses. And what was cool, I found this really interesting article that unpacked this in terms of the way this actually works in game theory format, is to sort of imagine the scenarios like we've talked about before and imagine sort of what are the potential outcomes. So in sort of the first scenario they describe is what they would call an extensive form game with two rounds where you have two civilizations. And in this particular situation, right, both civilizations are aware of each other, let's say. And let's say that just, you know, flip of the coin, one civilization gets to go first in terms of their actions, right? And then the other civilization gets to respond, essentially. And each civilization has sort of two options is the way they describe it. And then you can feel free to jump in here and criticize if you want to. But what they say is there's two options in terms of actions you can engage in. You can destroy the other civilization or you can do nothing. Okay.
Oh, wow. And they That's it? That's all you get? Well, that's a tough game.
Yeah, well, so here I think they're, to some extent, taking into account factors like, you know, if you haven't solved Scut, right, the ability to even communicate with the other entity in any sort of, like, reasonable period of time would be extremely difficult. So, like, I think they're trying to say that it would be nearly impossible for you to have functional communication with them. So your options are either just let them continue to exist. Or you can just send something to destroy them. I'm sort of trying to... Here's what I'll say, right? I think it's a little weird the way they've phrased the game theory here. It does seem to me that there is a third option of communicating, but that the third option of communicating is effectively doing nothing plus signaling to the other species that you exist,
right.
could well, just sure result in you getting destroyed.
They're trying to, like, isolate variables a little bit and, you know...
Right, exactly.
It's not necessarily meant to be, like, a realistic, per se.
Right, and so what they... Yeah, and so what they basically argue is, right, the potential outcomes if you destroy them are... Sorry, if you... If you get destroyed, right, that's infinite negative badness, obviously. Whereas if you destroy them, you not only eliminate a potential threat, but you get access to the finite resources that they had access to, right? So you get some sort of better than zero benefit from destroying them in this kind of way, right? Whereas they argue if you don't do anything... And it becomes the other species' turn, in a sense, right? They have the same options. Either they destroy you and get the same net benefit that you would have gotten, or they do nothing and get zero benefit. So basic game theory would say if your options are either infinite negative outcome, zero net benefit either way, or some greater than zero benefit, right? The rational thing to do would be, in every situation, to destroy the other civilization. With me so far?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I do think there are features of the universe that they talk about that I think make this more plausible that, like, things end up in this very pessimistic place. Another thing would be that technology advancements occur sort of non-linearly, right? That, like, people can have random massive advances in technology. So you might think, for example, well, I only need to destroy species that are as strong as me or stronger or something like that, right? I don't have to worry about Deltons or Pavs or something like that. But as we will come to discover in later books, right, even a less developed species, right, if you try to interact with them in a peaceful kind of way, you may be creating a situation that inevitably tends towards violence on a galactic scale. So things like, you know, if one of those species is naturally aggressive but is not acting aggressively because they know they are at a significant technological disadvantage, they could still, you know, alert your, you know, alert a stronger species of your existence as a sort of trying to sic something bigger on you. Or if they manage to advance their own technology enough, they could still pose some sort of risk to other people's well-being.
Yeah, I mean, obviously this has to kind of simplify a lot, simplify a lot of things down.
Right.
Like, for example, I mean, I don't know that in the real world, I don't know how easy it is to just quote unquote destroy a civilization or a planet or whatever. I mean, so there's all kinds of like other calculations that might go into that. I mean, there's also, you know, what if you set up like we saw in the Cold War? What if we set up like a dead hand kind of thing where it's like maybe a solution to this is we set up, you know, we've got our weapons on some other planet that you don't know about that there's no way to, you know, like, and it's set to go off and kill anything that kills us kind of thing. Like if that's a weird solution to the game theory problem, which is like, if you don't do anything to us, you're fine. If you do something to us, then you also will get attacked. Sort of like how, you know, I think the Russians had that or tried to set that up or maybe did, or we did, or one or the other, I can't remember, but that's sort of a weird game theory solution to it where it actually eases tensions in a way. Cause it's like, even though you've set up another weapon, which, you know, sounds like it wouldn't ease tensions, it kind of did. Cause it's like, well, that means, you know, it's a huge disincentive to strike first or which, cause the problem with, you know, a lot of the Cold War calculations was like, do we need to just strike first? But I think it's a lot of the same stuff, the same game theory where it's like, you know, the cost of being the second entity to try to launch nukes is you're dead, you know? And so like any risk of that is too catastrophic to not take.
I think that's right. And I think it's exacerbated by, so, you know, when you look at the Cold War, for example, right? The reason mutually assured destruction didn't turn into actual everyone being destroyed, right, is continued open lines of communication. So I think when you look at what I've been talking about with trying to communicate across these very large spaces, you could imagine that the risk of someone misinterpreting a signal or just becoming increasingly paranoid, right, could lead to a triggering because you don't feel like you have successful ways of interacting with the species across these long distances. So I do think there is a sense in which, even if it is a similar kind of scenario, the odds are worse at a galactic level than they were even at a national level on our own planet. But I do agree that there are, and it's interesting the way that the different theories that the Bobs come up with for ways to work around this problem. I particularly like something that's going to happen in one of the later books, so I don't want to spoil it, but I think they have at least one interesting way of trying to figure out a way out of the dark forest that I've sort of been describing here. I want to tie this to something else as well before we run out of time here on the main show. I want to note that I think this is one applied example of the kind of long-termism, effective altruism that we've talked about, I think, a little bit before, and folks might sort of be sort of broadly familiar with when we, I think we've talked about X risk and things on the show, but the idea that like a good utilitarian or a good consequentialist should be, if they're trying to really produce as much, you know, or, you know, the maximal amount of utility possible, they would look more to the future and think about, you know, there are hundreds of billions of people who could potentially live good lives if everyone on the planet isn't wiped out by an asteroid. And therefore, we should put a substantial amount of our resources towards preventing those kinds of either very long-term or very small likelihood but high out, you know, high impact events. And I think you could argue that one such kind of X risk is something like the others, that like we should be reasonably concerned or something that we are like the PAV, you know, a species that's in the radius of a being like that and just hasn't gotten picked off yet because of, you know, the, like you said, there's a lot of time out there, and that we should be trying to figure out some way to make ourselves less vulnerable to a threat like that.
Yeah. Why can't we all just get along, though? That's the thing.
Yeah. Because there's a bunch of incentives not to, I guess. I mean, it's the flip side of all of this, I think, that the skeptics, I think, need to deal with in terms of being pessimistic about outcomes is the kind of collaborative bootstrapping that is possible between species that we see within the Bobiverse, the taking of technologies from different species, sometimes, you know, through force in the case of the others, or through more peaceful means, does allow for a synergizing that increases quality of life for lots of people. So I do think that, like, part of the game theory has to acknowledge that, you know, there could be sort of like when we talk about AI superintelligences, that, like, there's a potentially infinite upshot if you get it right. The problem is the odds of getting it right so infinitesimally small compared to the odds of getting murdered.
Yeah, I don't know how seriously to take all this, because it just feels like the space is too much of a barrier. I don't know, like, it's just too wide open. There's too much space. And with the light speed being always the limiting factor, like, you know, why would you even bother trying to take out a civilization light years and light years and light years away in one direction? You know, it's like, all right, there's plenty of space out here. But I don't know, maybe that's just me not... Is there some is it that, like, when you take into account these von Neumann probes or something like that that can theoretically replicate, eventually you run out of space?
Maybe. I mean, I think it's very debatable what happens at that scale. So I think the pushback to that.
But then if you get to that point, then I don't think you have this push a button to eliminate a civilization thing anyway. You know, like, if you get to the point where both you and or this other hypothetical game theory civilization that you're gaming against, you know, are that big or powerful, I don't know that you would have the ability to push a button and take them out in any meaningful way if they're spread out in different systems, you know. So I feel like that would complicate the situation quite a bit, and that maybe this game theory example is interesting to get kind of the basic intuitions going. But, you know, when you take into account how impossible it might be to actually destroy the entirety of another civilization, I don't know if this would work out.
Yeah, I am sympathetic to that. I actually just finished the first book in the Culture series, which deals with a war between the culture and another species that I think very much kind of supports your argument, in the sense that the culture as a distributed entity is effectively unkillable, and that, like,
yeah,
you know, what you get is basically sort of an endless war. Well, not an endless, but like a sort of protracted, sort of rather silly war, in a sense, a rather pointless kind of endeavor that, like, eventually peters out, I think, is more the sense of what happens there. So I do think I'm sympathetic to the idea that the vastness of space could undercut the functionality of conventional warfare. And I think what we see in the Bobiverse are entities that have not yet achieved sort of culture level civilization. And I think we could argue is that entities at those levels are still stuck in a kind of game theory that they haven't, haven't been able to transcend yet.
That's definitely interesting about things like the Others or the Borg or whatever, where it's like, they have super high levels of technology, but not, seemingly, by our standards, I guess, not high levels of, like, philosophy or ethics or anything like that. Because you would hope, you know, hypothetically, that any civilization that could reach this kind of power would also come to understand, or at least come to believe certain things. Like, my feeling, like, if I were a president of, you know, some civilization, spacefaring civilization, I'd be like, well, sure, maybe something could kill us, but, like, how bad is that anyway? Whatever. I would rather not, when you're facing the decision of, like, destroying an entire civilization, I would rather take that risk than live with the idea that we are proactively destroying entire civilizations, is what I mean. Like, not that I would be, like, totally nihilistic about life, per se, on everybody's behalf, but that it would be like, all right, well, yes, there is the catastrophic downside if we could get destroyed, but the cost of going around and living like this and dealing with that. And then you would think, okay, hopefully every other advanced civilization would come to that conclusion, maybe, you know, and then you know, it would take a bit of faith, I suppose, but it would be like, hopefully everybody else is going through this calculation too, where they're thinking, if game theory is telling us this, we can all solve the prisoner's dilemma together in a way. If you would hope that people would be advanced enough. Now, obviously that probably won't be true, but that would be, I don't know. That would be what I would just hope.
Well, I would say this is actually beautifully tracks when we talked about the orthogonality thesis with AI superintelligences, where, you know, you would hope that as the AI bootstrap up their superintelligence, they bootstrap up their ethics as well, in a sense. But I think Bostrom is right that in that situation, there's no necessarily correlation between intelligence and ethics, essentially, that you could get an extremely intelligent being that does not act or think ethically in the way that we would want it to. And I think that transfers over probably to aliens as well, that like there's just – there could be, you know, super intelligent, omnibenevolent beings out there. But there's no reason, I think, to hope or assume that beings that make it into space are necessarily highly advanced philosophically in that kind of way. They may have just found other adaptations that make it easy or functional for them to get into space that have nothing to do with being good people in that kind of sense.
Yeah.
And
which makes the others super scary.
Yeah, it does. And something else I'll add, even if you are sympathetic to your kind of, and I would say your mindset is a very culture mindset in the sense of that kind of almost radically pacifistic, I would rather not be the one who murders those people even to save a billion more lives or something like that, which I'm sympathetic to. It does, again, like we've talked about in self-defense situations, get challenging when you start thinking about the well-being of other species, right? It might be one thing to be willing to say, I'm okay with letting my civilization die off if need be, but do I have a moral obligation to save the Pavs from a similar fate in some way? And I find it hard to totally walk away from that obligation to some extent. Like, much like we've seen in various Star Trek episodes, when people are being attacked and oppressed throughout the universe, there is a natural inclination to sort of step in and try to help. But at a galactic level, there's always going to be, it seems like, the possibility of being able to step in and help more. So I wonder if there's any way to ever sort of cap that or anything.
I thought you were going to say there's always a bigger fish.
There is always a bigger fish, it seems like.
Well, we are way out of time, so that's we're going to have to go after dark, as usual, yeah. But we've got to do what we do every show, which is preview for next week.
Yeah, we're going to go on to book three. So my feeling is that, generally speaking, each of these books has about one episode worth of, like, good, meaty, philosophical content before it'll start to drag. So we're going to do a book a week. We'll do book three next week and then book four the following week, which is about as long as I think it really takes to get through these books for the most part. So yeah, that's our preview. And we're going to talk about the interaction between Bobs and Ephemerals, and whether there's a sort of running thesis through the books about whether or not Bobs are benefited by or hindered by their relationships to Ephemerals. So I think that's a really interesting question to dive into some more.
Yeah. And also, what are our top patrons at patreon.com/zeroG having you say this week?
As a human, I was ill-equipped to thank you, but as myself, you have my everlasting gratitude.
Yeah, thanks to our strong AI patrons, Dapper Dawkins, Daddy Deals, Deconverters Dosh, Gabby, just barely outrunning being pecked to death by lame ducks. No good patron name ideas this week, so Anathem, 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 Winchester's Forever, Thomas's Appa Plush Fund, Dude, Corey Ebert, Aaron's French accent is my favorite accent, I Want to Be the Tempeh in a Foucault and Camus sandwich, Jesse Urbanowitz and Brenda Goodman, The Coronavirus Apocalypse is making me too depressed to think of anything clever this week, Anathem episodes make my pussy throb, Chad T, and all the top tier, definitely not a clone, experiencing zero replicant drift, thanks to Sam Buck and No Commute So Behind on podcasts.
And that's our show. Join us after dark at patreon.com/zeroG. As we said, plenty to talk about this time and every week If not, we'll see you next time for Bobaverse Book 3.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at zeroG philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.